Super. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun. This is Lynn Johnson with Bruce Rawls, and we are and have been reading through Gary Renard's newest book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And we have finally gotten to this section where I think he's going to be talking about the scribing of A Course in Miracles, which is Jesus's latest contribution. Well, I don't know about his latest contribution. Who knows what's happened since this? But as far as to the teaching that is here to unshake us from our ego beliefs and return us to the reality of the real world, this is you know what we're doing now with the Course in Miracles. And so we are reading again through this book. And Bruce, you know, what's been going on with you since last I heard from you? Anything interesting?
Well, I think we're getting pretty close to launching the new FIP site, so that's kind of fun. It's keeping me very, very busy, and along with other projects. What else? Nothing particular at the moment that comes to mind, but anyway... just having fun with my usual connections with folks in the course and around the planet and doing the usual stuff, I guess. So how about yourself?
Yeah, pretty much the same. Nothing. You know, I spent some time with my grandkids this, you know, Thursday night and just kind of getting ready to, you know, think about going and getting some medical tests, which I'm not real excited about, but I guess which are necessary as you get older. Things seem to fall apart, and just like your house, you know, if you don't take care of it and keep the plumbing straightened up and everything, then you're eventually going to have a problem. So I'm getting my plumbing checked.
Nothing like a good oil change, break in front in alignment, and you know, brake job, right?
That's right. You know, you got to do it. Regular maintenance. Yep. So that's all I'm doing is, you know, concentrating on the health of the body, while at the same time, you know, recognizing that it really is just an exercise in futility because, there's no preventing the eventual, downfall of the body. And, you know, do you recognize or realize, I'm sure you've been around the course community enough and spent enough time with different people with different ideas and different teachings. There are people who believe that if you really get this course, that the body will live forever, that the body will not get sick and will not die, and that they point to that as the reason to believe that, you know, perhaps maybe Ken Wapnick or Ramana Maharshi or, you know, some of these guys who are great teachers of non-dualism really were not awake or enlightened or whatever because their bodies died from illness. And they're thinking that if they're getting sick or their body is not healthy or well, that they're not doing the course right and or that you're not doing the course right. And I find that just fascinating, absolutely fascinating, how people could come to a conclusion like that, reading the same book that you and I have been reading for all these years. Because it seems to me like it's just the opposite is what Jesus is saying. But they take this idea that, you know, if the teacher of God, his body will be, you know, whatever, will be perfectly healthy to be able to do whatever he needs to do. Or I think they're misunderstanding the meaning of health, the definition of health and the definition of sickness. And sickness is a defense against the truth. And that's any defense against the truth is a sickness. The body is a defense against the truth.
Right.
It's considered, you know, it's not the body.
If I can jump in, it's not the body. It's not the body. It's the belief that there is a thought system that necessitated the formation of a dream of a body. That's the defense against the truth. I think that's more to the point, don't you think? Because it's really the idea that there has to be some way of making a substitute for a love and a peace and an innocence and a joyous experience beyond anything we can imagine that we thought we had forsaken. And on some level, we're not even consciously aware of. And that's what, of course, Miracles and Ken Wapnick's wonderful, you know, prolific material goes into such great detail about the unconscious guilt and the amazing lengths that we went to make up a world that really is a holographic dream that we have invested so much of our identity in. Because our minds are so powerful, we're actually able to believe that we are separate individuals and that these individual ideas have bodies. And you know, we don't even question that. I mean, that's just such an everyday thing. So that when when the resistance to that comes up, naturally it's going to take the form of, well, let's make it about the form. Let's make it about the body. And physical immortality is sort of an oxymoron in the sense that how can something in truth that never exist, if you really read what is literally suggested in A Course in Miracles, you know, there is no world. This is the central thought of course attempts to teach. Then how could a body within that world exist in truth? And it basically on a level of form, in the level of the appearance within the dream, sure. And like you say, you know, go to the doctor, get the test, tune up your car, do the repairs on your house, you know, be normal, do all that stuff. But that isn't what A Course in Miracles is about. It's about looking at the contents of the mind, seeing that there was no cause for the unconscious guilt that seems to be there. And by looking at it with our inner kindness teacher, which is the voice of this wonderful work, we incorporate that as our identity more and more over time, and recognize that that voice has never left us and speaks to us and through us throughout the day. And if we begin to listen to that more fully, we come to recognize that, you know, a body is just a convenience for expressing the mind, but the mind doesn't require the body. But we've got it so backwards. We think that we have to have a body in order to have a mind. You know, that's kind of the ego's. And then of course the mind that's predicated on the body can only be truly about guilt and fear and the crazy idea that separation happened, which we abbreviate to sin. I think substitution, specialness, and separation, those are three words that I always kind of remind myself are an expansion of the word sin, because they all three of those have the letters S-I-N in them. And so that's whenever I see that word, it's like, okay, separation, substitution, specialness, those cover a lot of ground there. So, but you know, like you're saying, you know, the body is really just an idea that in truth bodies are never born and they never die because they're part of a universe that never was. But that's, you know, we can't wrap our heads around that on an everyday basis all the time. So what we have to do is work with the curriculum that the Course presents to us where we think we're at, and that's through the mechanism of forgiveness in our relationships. And instead of trying to jump right to oneness, we go to sameness and see that we all have the same thought system of insanity we call ego. We have this all have the same thought system of sanity, which we call Holy Spirit or inner kindness teacher or whatever we want to, the right mind of thinking, whatever we want to call that. And then the decision making faculty to choose between them. So everyone has those three, elements, if you will. And we're all constantly using the decision maker to choose one of those two thought systems. And that's what determines what appears to be our life, and we see that reflected in the world. But the reflection is just a mirroring at best of a decision in the mind. And sometimes that mirroring, in terms of our bodies, takes the form of a healthy body. Sometimes it doesn't. But if the mind is at peace, what difference does it make if the body appears to be healthy or not? If the body is something that isn't our real identity, if we gradually transition our identity from a thought system that says the body is where I'm at to one that says spirit is what I am and what everyone is, and we're all that same thing together, that same essence, that same awareness, then eventually there's nothing left in the bodily identification that attracts us. So we're not attracted to death. We're not attracted to, as the Course suggests we are, we're not attracted to all the obstacles that we put in the way. You know, the first obstacle is the desire to get rid of it. So, and eventually we realize, okay, maybe this mind really is where it's at, and I could shift my identity to that exclusively, while still appearing to be in the world and doing all the normal things, but just not making a big deal about them. I think that's the grace and the ease that comes with time over, after practicing, of course, for an extended period of time. And it's a slow process, and we need to be really patient with ourselves and with each other, including other course students.
Yeah. Well, and what's so beautiful about this course is, Jesus gives us ways to look at things. Like today's lesson, which I just was doing with a group that I meet with on Saturday mornings, and the lesson is I am at home, fear is a stranger here. And you read through this whole lesson is talking about everything in this world seems to be the opposite of what you think it is. You think that you are the stranger. You think that you're not at home, and you think that your brother is a stranger. And we get it goes through. Jesus talks to us very logically about what is the actual situation here. But the last two paragraphs of the lesson, after he's gone through all this discussion about, why wouldn't you recognize this? What is it that's keeping you from seeing yourself at home with God? And he says, lesson 160, paragraph 9, he says, "Today we offer thanks that Christ has come to search the world for what belongs to him." Which kind of gives you the idea of, this picture of Jesus, with his little searchlight going around looking. But it's really the Christ is searching for what is the Christ. And his vision sees no strangers, but beholds his own and joyously unites with them. They see him as a stranger, for they do not recognize themselves. Yet as they give him welcome, they remember. And he leads them gently home again, where they belong. And so the last paragraph, he really hits us, bam, in here's the real truth. Not one does Christ forget. Not one he fails to give you to remember that your home may be complete and perfect as it was established. He has not forgotten you, but you will not remember him until you look on all as he does. Who denies his brother is denying him, and thus refusing to accept the gift of sight by which his self is clearly recognized, his home remembered, and salvation come. So, Jesus points it right there. Boom, here it is. You don't see the Christ in your brother, you're not going to see the Christ in yourself. You don't see the goodness of the sameness, the connection between you and your brother. How can you possibly see your own self as the Christ? And so he's pretty well given it to us. Giving and receiving are the same thing. If I give you your Christ nature and I say you are the Christ, whole, healed, and innocent, all is forgiven and released. unless I can look at my brother and see that, I will never, ever see it in myself. So I always see myself as being worthless and weak and homeless, basically. I mean, this is it. I'm seeing myself as homeless. So, you know, he really is giving us this very clear instruction about how to do it. And yet, for me, you know, pretty much of the time, I'm still saying, that jerk, or what did they do, or this is wrong, or, you know, how can people live like that, or how can people treat people like that, or, you know, racial profiling, why would somebody do that? You know, I'm doing it myself. Everything I see my brother doing wrong and connect in my mind, this is not right, I'm doing it myself right there, just from that. But in reality, I'm doing it myself in all ways that I'm not conscious of. So Jesus is saying, wake up, pay attention to your thinking, recognize that you're doing this. And when you recognize that you're doing this and you stop it, you will definitely see a shift and a change in your thinking, in your life, in your experience, and in the way the world is. The world is going to be a different place. You know, you're going to be seeing a completely different world if you do this. So, you know, that's the incentive. And yet, you know, how many of us are willing to give up our opinions about, you know, certain people that we think are, you know, problem, and not paying attention to the fact that the fact that I think is a problem is the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you covered a lot of ground there. And one of the, I think the more challenging but crucial ideas in the course is that we can't leave anyone out of our mind's embrace for our identity. And we do that in countless ways, but you know, you listed a bunch of them right there, you know, in terms of all the different, you know, thoughts that disparage or otherwise condemn or judge others for how can they fill in the blanks, and the whole idea of, you know, our language kind of reveals, either betrays us or reveals to us, depending on which thought system we're using, but it reveals to us, you know, when we're in ego mode, when we make a big deal out of the we they distinctions and forget that everything that we see outside of us is a projection, and it's you know, that's actually going to be the theme of the virtual conference that's happening this fall, is, you know, forgiving our projections and really forgiving the projector, which is the decision in the mind that made up this crazy idea that somehow I think I can escape from the consequences of unconscious guilt by projecting it outward. And it's just silly. You know, when we recognize that the problem is not outside, it's inside the mind, A, and then B, the problem when we look at it with our inner kindness teacher doesn't exist. You put those two things together and there really is no problem that awareness can't solve. But that's not what the world, you know, reveres and idolizes and glamorizes and rhapsodizes about victimhood in countless ways and supports that mental lifestyle and habit. So we just need to kind of look at that and say, how important is that to me to maintain this martyrdom, victimhood, we, they, you know, dichotomy, divisive thought system? And can I look at all the ways that I do that with a gentle kindness and say, I can see peace inside of this. I can choose differently. And that oftentimes does affect what we do in the world, but it doesn't have to change anything dramatically necessarily. We probably still do on the level of form a lot of the same things, but we just do them more kindly. We don't go out of our way to make big deals out of what appear to be differences, but instead we go out of our way in our mind to make sure that everyone feels included and that we, honor and respect, not the individual for the sake of individuality, but the spirit that every seeming individual embodies, and that, you know, we share that camaraderie and that true relationship that the Course calls the Christ, I think we could see it as just the pure oneness that we never left. So anyway,
exactly, and that does take a different kind of vision. So to stop looking at the weakness and the smallness of my brother and imagining him to be separate and different and outside of me, and just start looking at my own thoughts about my brother, which are the only reality that I have. I don't really see you. I don't really know you. I don't really see or know anyone. Even my closest, my husband, my children, I don't really see them or know them. I only see and know the picture I have in my mind of what they are. And so that's what I have to look at. I don't have to look at you and your behavior. I have to look at the pictures in my mind, the stories I'm telling myself about you and about your body and about your works and the things you've done. That's what really makes the shift. And, I'm always working on myself. I'm always looking at myself and I'm always thinking about myself. And if I think that I'm thinking about or working for or doing something for somebody else, I'm mistaken. It's not possible because there is no relationship between me and you. Right. The only relationship is between me, the Holy Spirit, and what I am. That's the only relationship. If I have a relationship with the Holy Spirit, then I have a relationship with you. If I have a relationship with the Holy Spirit, I have a relationship with myself. And that's the only true relationship. And that's actually a holy relationship.
Exactly.
As opposed to the special relationship that I have with your body and your voice and your words and your, that's all special relationship. The only real relationship we have is the Christ with the Christ.
Yeah.
But that's my thought. That's how
That makes so much sense. I mean, and as you're saying that, I was thinking, well, the self, we're always selfish. But the difference is between the two thought systems is there's the lowercase s selfishness, which is all about differences and what's in it for me at the expense of everyone else. But the capital S self is really just the opposite, which is really ultimately transcends opposites because it includes everyone. And that's, again, the challenge is that capital S self is impeccably, purely one. And that all-inclusiveness basically gently insists and persists with the idea that there can be nothing outside myself. So if I perceive something, then that's truly part of this capitalist self that we all are and all share. But if I see it as outside of myself, then I'm perpetuating an illusion. I'm perpetuating a belief in differences or separation or sin, as of course we'd call it. Just shorthand, just getting a separation, substitution, and specialness. Compressed down to three letters. Well, sin's a pretty good, but it's not the biblical sin that can't be undone. It's, of course, basically the Holy Spirit's correction for the ego's idea of sin is that it's just an error. It's not evil, wicked, or anything else. It's just silly. It's just truly silly, and that's I think what makes this a delightful process to go through. I mean, it's not easy. But when we're actually doing it, we're actually in the midst of forgiving ourselves and forgiving each other as seemingly, catalytic processes by reeling those things back in that we've condemned outside of ourselves and realize, oh, this is just something that I don't like on myself, and it's unfounded. I can afford to let this go because it never happened in truth. I can forgive my brother for what he hasn't done, in truth, in eternity. And then we're off the hook and they're off the hook. And then we see through the sameness that we're getting glimpses of the oneness that we never left. So, should we go back on the reading?
Absolutely. You want to read, where we're at?
We were on page 118. I was going to back up about half a page to get the context.
Okay.
And read where he starts in. This is Gary's narration and then his teachers appear right after this first short paragraph. This is, again, we actually, the last time we read a couple weeks ago was just to put the context in it before we get going. In Gary Renard's fourth book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions, we're reading from chapter 8, Jay channeled 1965 to 1977. This time the truth will not be buried. And this is about the scribing of a course. So anyway, Gary starts with this short narration, and he says, I wanted to have a dialogue with my teachers about many course ideas. It had been a few years since we really got into it. One afternoon, they were back again. And now the trilogue, I guess you could say, continues. Artin, so we can tell you want to talk about the course. You've certainly done more than your share of traveling around the world to teach it. What would you like to talk about? Gary, there's so much. The course says, the miracle establishes you dream a dream and that its content is not true. But a lot of students seem to have a big problem going all the way with that. I mean, I'll say that according to the course, the absolute truth is this, God is. And they don't seem to have much of a problem with that. But then if you tell them nothing else is, you can see the resistance on a lot of their faces. They can get the truth of God, but they can't get that absolutely nothing about the world and their lives is real. Yes, the course is the most radical teaching in history. That's why most of the people who teach it don't teach it. Even if they understand it, which is very rare, it's not easy to explain to people that they don't exist, that they never have. Their life is a lie. The only place they really exist is in God and the physical universe, including their own bodies and personal identities, not to mention those of everyone they've ever known, has never been true. And, oh, by the way, their children are illusions, too. Gary, yeah, I try not to start off with that.
Oh, you know, it's something that just made me think of something in that show Westworld that I'm so over the moon about. And I don't know if you watched.
I've seen a little bit of a few episodes, but not much. Yeah, I get the general idea, though. Yeah.
In this newer season, the AI, the folks, the hosts are becoming conscious and it's like really an amazing thing. But the one main character, this Dolores, this female host or artificial intelligence person.
Robot, basically, right?
Basically, yeah. But, you know, like we are robots. But one of the characters is looking for her daughter. Her child who was ripped away from her in another incarnation, many, many, many incarnations ago. But she still has this memory of having this child. And so she tells this Dolores, Dolores says, you want to come with us or something? And she goes, no, I have to go and find my child. And Dolores says to her, and I can't quote it, and I'm going to go look for it and actually be able to quote it. She says, because the child, all these things are implanted into their memories. These are not real things. These are just implanted in their memories. And she says, they give you those to hold on to you, to keep you. So these memories, these thoughts, these ideas of this is my child, this is the thing that latches me, connects me to the world. And as long as I keep looking for my child and thinking about my child, I'm remaining connected to this illusion and not recognizing the fact that there is no child. This child was an illusion and a dream. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, that's it. It's these children and it's these things that I love and these things that I think are so important. That's how the ego has me hooked. That's the hook that has got me dangling. And it's not even real. It's an artificial relationship, an artificial construct. That doesn't mean I don't love my children. I do. I adore them. But, you know, when I look at them, what is it that I love about them? I love them because I have a sense of responsibility that I must love them because I'm their mother and they're my children. I look at them and I think I have a responsibility to love them because they're humans and they're outside of me. I think all these thoughts that I have about why I should negate completely the fact that they really don't exist except in my own mind and the fact that I don't even exist as a human. It's all in my mind. This is what keeps everything in play, is this engagement and this belief that somehow or the other things are supposed to be a certain way. And, you know, these are, you know, cultural beliefs or, you know, of course a mother loves her children. You know, these are, and these are the things that tug at our heart and keep us engaged. But, anyway, I just thought because Artin said that about your children, that's true. They don't exist. They never have. Their life is a lie. The only place they exist is in God and the physical universe, including their own bodies and personal identities, which you were just reading. Including those that they have ever known have never been true. And their children are illusions too. That's it. Anyway, continue reading. I'm sorry.
That's an excellent commentary, and I think it ties into the normal thing is that as one of Ken Wapnick's programs was entitled "Parents and Children Are Our Most Difficult Classroom," suggests is that we really have a huge investment in these familial relationships as a mechanism for keeping the ego intact. And so, it's sometimes easier to work with, like business people or people you didn't pass on the highway or the sidewalk or whatever that, seem to be just, occasional or casual encounters with various people, and start our mindfulness and forgiveness practice with those that are not, day in, day out, heavily invested, participants, because that way we can see that we can do this and then apply it to what for most people are more difficult and more challenging situations, which is parents, children, and the investment that we have in those relationships, because we've invested our identity in a projected way, we can also reinvest identity in the reality. And I think that's what this next paragraph is getting into, I think it's about to talk about that here a bit. So why don't I just dive back into that? Gary says, yeah, I try not to start off with that, meaning that the world doesn't exist and anything physical is an illusion or a dream. Of course, Jay doesn't leave you hanging. He doesn't just describe the unreality of the ego, say the world is an illusion and get lost. That teaching won't do anything for you except maybe make you depressed. What the Course does is completely replace the thought system of the ego with the thought system of the Holy Spirit. I've been looking at spiritual thought systems for almost 40 years, ever since I got into EST, and I've never seen anything else do that. Most of the teachings are good at describing the problem. I don't know, quick aside, I think that was one of the things that Ken Wapnick points out about Freud, is he's brilliant at describing the ego and its strategies and its cleverness and all that kind of stuff. But what Freud didn't do is, grok the idea that there was another thought system that could lead you out of that insanity. So anyway, I'll go on. Most of the teachings are good at describing the problem. A lot of experts and big shot psychologists are very adept at talking about the ego and all the problems of the world. At best, they'll give you a method that will make you feel better. But that's a temporary fix. It doesn't undo the ego. It placates it by glossing things over. The Course, on the other hand, actually gives you a way out. It gives you a resolution to the entire problem of human existence. It takes you all the way home to heaven, which you never really left except in a false experience. So it replaces a false experience with a true experience. But actually undoing the ego takes time and work. A lot of people who go to a workshop expect to be enlightened that weekend. Persa. So you do the same thing as Jay. You explain to them what you do, what to do, and you point them in the right direction. When we say the Course is the most radical teaching in history, you've got to remember that almost all the teachings and thought systems in history are based on the so-called wisdom of the ages and universal truths. But those truths and wisdom are not true, and the Course is not the same as them. Why? Because they're all based on the universe being real. Even the non-dualistic teachings are taken by the world and evolved into making the air real. That's why the Course says in describing the world, any mistake can be corrected if truth be left to judge it. But if the mistake is given the status of truth, to what can it be brought?
Wow. Yeah. That's
Isn't that great? Yeah. I was thinking, you know, how, you know, the Course describes, you know, bringing the darkness to the light. But if you're calling the darkness light, then you're not going to get very far.
Exactly.
Which is what that last quote was alluding to, right?
And I'm thinking about other people who are publishing the Course themselves, who have an objection to whatever was edited in or out of the FIP version of the Course, and they say things like, well, Jesus took the soul out, and we each have an individual soul. Or not Jesus, but Ken. They say Ken took the soul out because, you know, they think that Ken was the one who did the editing, which is complete misconception, a complete misnomer, absolutely. Because I heard it from Helen herself on a recording and talked to other people who were there, like John Lundy, and he said they asked Jesus about everything that they put in or took out. But the idea that Jesus took that Ken took the soul out, and we each have an individual soul, that's a complete misconception. There is no such thing as an individual soul in oneness. There can't be, you know, 7 billion or, you know, and that's not even considered, that's only considering here on Earth. You know, what about all the, you know, beings in all the galaxies far, far away and all that? You know, they're not each individual beings. You know, the cells in my body appear to be individual beings because they're living creatures and they have their own autonomy. Do they have their own soul too? You know, you can't go back and rearrange things. Now there's someone else who's re-edited the Course and has a whole big old volume with all kinds of explanations of it. And I listened to that person talk, and it was very clear to me that person believes that the world is real and that the body is real and that the body was made by God and the world was made by God. And so, you know, they took everything that they could that seemed evidence of that and emphasized that instead of emphasizing, you know, Jesus saying, you know, there is no world. That's the primary point of this Course. and so even if people have it, they don't believe it, and they want to change it to make it into something they believe. And I'm afraid I do the same thing. You know, there's many, many, many times when I'm thinking of blaming God or asking God for things or expecting that something's going to change in the world or the universe because of something I think needs to change, I'm making the same mistake. Until you come to the recognition that the world is not real, then you're not going to be able to change, make them that mistake whole, because you're still giving the mistake the status of the truth.
Yep. Yeah. We're making the dream real.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're basically making the illusion of separation real every time we condemn, every time we, you know, say, well, there's a difference that's important. And that includes, you know, making a big deal out of people who have different interpretations of things, including our curriculum. So that just gives us an opportunity to look at, you know, how afraid we all are to having that experience of the pure peace. Because we think that we all think on some level, or we wouldn't need this, you know, remedial curriculum, that there's something in the world that's going to do it for us. We're still holding out that, you know, someday we're going to figure out just the right combination of circumstances in the world that's going to make us happy. Even though consciously, if we really thought about it, it's like, well, I don't hold out much hope for that. But on some unconscious level, I think we believe that somehow there's, you know, things are going to get better and the world's going to, you know, like a Disney movie, you know, the flowers are going to start blooming. And the Course uses that kind of language, but it's never talking about the world. It's talking about, when it talks about, you know, the being gently carried down a path in summer and the flowers saving all their fragrance for you and the birds chirping and the, you know, the springs coming to life and, you know, all those kind of seemingly flowery descriptions, they're not talking about the world. They're talking about the mind of one who has accepted the idea that they're, you know, the world is not going to do it for us, but the thought system that leads us out of the world, which sees everyone as in the same boat, and that we all have the same reality that hasn't been scathed or messed up or butchered by an insane ego thought system. If we can remember that there is, you know, a perfect peace that we never left, and that's what we're, you know, appearing to navigate back to. We never left it, but we, you know, we seem to be traversing a script that takes us back to that place in the mind where we can accept that consistently, and then eventually just drop the whole trying to make our ego bucket list work. You know, that's something that we need to be patient with ourselves and with everyone that's in our life.
Absolutely. And that's actually being patient with myself with that. Yeah. Is exactly. The most important. I mean, it's the only thing I can do. Because if I'm blaming everybody else and looking at everybody else and thinking that they're the ones that are doing something wrong, then I'm never going to see the problem where it is. I'm only going to see the problem outside of myself and never, ever get the idea that it's really my own thoughts that are the problem. So, well put. Thank you. All right. So I'll continue reading. Persa had said any mistake can be corrected if truth be left to judge it, but the mistake is given the status of truth to what can it be brought. And then Gary says, that's another thing. People have been taught all their lives that God created the world. Now, I didn't have a problem with the idea that God didn't create this world and in fact doesn't have anything to do with it. For me, that came as a tremendous relief. Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't understand how God could allow such terrible things to happen to good people. Then it turned out it wasn't him who did it, which that's my thoughts too. It was us, the one ego appearing as many through the idea of separation. This is our projection, and heaven is still perfect. But some people are still married to the idea of this being some beautiful thing created by the divine, even though everything in it decays, falls apart, and dies. And that's if you're lucky enough to survive that long. God did not make this world and has nothing to do with it.
My comments sometimes, you know, mental, I don't usually express this verbally, but when people think, oh well, you know, things are getting better, I just say, you know, not to be, you know, a pessimist, but just to, you know, realistically about the outcome of this dream is all you have to do is add one thing to everyone's life, and it doesn't look quite as rosy. And that one thing would be a century, you know. I don't think many people really would want it, to be progressed a century further in this particular lifetime. Even with unimaginably great medical advances, you'd still be left with the same thought system. And that's really the critical thing is, you know, what thought system is going to lead us out of the insanity of this world? And it's really the only one that makes sense is one that says that we're not here. You know, the way to find joy in a joyless place is to remember that we're not here.
Right. Yeah.
But all the while behaving in a way that's appropriate and normal, and you know, not trying to destroy the world. And make a big fuss and a ruckus in the world, but really recognizing that the revolution is in our mind, and the outer trappings are not where the real revolution is going on.
Exactly, and that is not that easily understood. But once you start even going down the road of that and asking the question, Jesus says, "Ask of all things, what is this for?" Mm-hmm. You know, that's a simple thing to say. What is this for? And once you recognize that you don't know, although you may think you know, and you may say, well, this is for this and this and this and this and this. But, you know, in reality, you don't know. We don't know the future. We don't even know the past. I don't even know what happened just a minute ago.
I'm clueless too.
I mean, yeah, we're clueless. So just come to the place where we recognize that, okay, I really don't know. And then you're ready to be taught something. But as long as you think you know, it's like, you know, I tell a story on my daughter here. When she was little, my older daughter was in tap ballet or whatever. And wow. So I got her into the ballet class for the little toddlers. And, you know, the first day she said, I already know how to do this. And I'm like, well, no, honey, you don't know how to do ballet. Yes, I do. I already know how to do it. I don't need to learn it. And she refused actually to do anything that the teacher told her to do. You know, basically I took her out of the class because it was obvious to me she was not willing to learn. And she was like four years old because she thought she already knew. And I look at that now and I think, well, geez, how many times do I get taken out of the toddler class? Because
as you're saying that, Lynn, I was thinking, well, wouldn't it be interesting if we, just for a few days, you know, or however long we could sustain it, every time we recognize that we're in the ego thought system, just kind of talk like, oh, I'm clueless, you know. Just use some kind of affected you know, a tone or something to remind ourselves that we're clueless. You know, of course, people around us would probably wonder what the hell's going on, but maybe we could
think you're having a stroke.
Make it an inward thing. You know, it's like, I think I'm clueless here. I just remembered I'm clueless. Yeah. Anyway.
That's funny. But you kind of sound like Eeyore there, too.
Thanks for noticing me.
Maybe a little.
Yeah, I tend to be an Eeyore, so... That's anyway. Okay, so let's see. So Gary is talking. He says, "Remember that weekend workshop I did at the Yoga Center in Massachusetts? There were several workshops going on there at the same time, and on Saturday night they had a thing where the speakers could do a 2-hour presentation in different rooms, and anybody attending any of the other workshops could come and hear you, sort of like an introduction to your work. Now, because it's a yoga center, you've got a lot of younger students there, and they're really into the body. I mean, you've got hormones flying all over the place. Plus, you know, if you've been in the yoga studio, you've got sweat and everything else flying around, too. Anyway, they think yoga is really spiritual, but what they really worship is bodies. So on Saturday night, I've got about 100 people, mostly in their 20s, coming in to hear me. And I'm wondering, what in the hell am I going to say to them? Before I went on, I did a short meditation like I always do and joined with the Holy Spirit. Incidentally, to me, you guys and Jay are all the Holy Spirit because once you get up to the level of Spirit, it's all the same. And I ask for any guidance for this presentation to these young people. Should I tell them the truth? Should I hold back? And I'm sure you remember the answer I got was this. See how many of them you can get to walk out on you. In other words, don't hold back at all. Give it to them straight. So I did. I would have anyway, but it was good to have that reassurance. Let me move to the next page. I'd say over the course of the 2 hours, about 20 of them did walk out on me. But a lot of the ones who stayed had these looks on their faces after I gave them some of the more radical stuff. And it was like they were saying, really? Is that really true? It was the first time a lot of them had heard a straight non-dualistic message. They were so used to making the world and the body real, it didn't occur to them that there was a completely different way of looking at things, one where they could have their cake and eat it too, because I wasn't telling them they had to give anything up. I was just telling them there was another interpretation that could save them a lot of time. And it's interesting that, you know, people got up and walked out, and I would hope that it wasn't because they were upset by his teaching. Maybe they just had someplace else to go is what I would think. But but the idea that, you know, telling the people that the world is not real, I knew that from the time I was little. I was really sure that was what Jesus was telling us. And I had a complete belief, you know, beliefs wise, other than, you know, of course I obviously took, you know, was worried for my body and didn't like pain and didn't like sickness and that kind of stuff. But I knew that wasn't the truth about what I was. And I also knew that this world is not my home because the Bible told me that. You know, they told me that in church and at school, you know, heaven is your home. So I already have these fundamental beliefs, but I didn't know what they meant. You know, they didn't have any meaning to me because they were beliefs and not knowledge. You know, what A Course in Miracles does is bring you into knowledge. You know, if you practice this stuff, you actually come to know that you are not this body. And, you know, you may have, you know, instances where that seems very clear, and other instances, which is most of the time for me, where, no, it's not. I very much feel like I am my body. I very much feel like I'm sitting in a chair. I very much feel like I'm breathing air, and if I wasn't breathing air, I would die. You know, I very much feel like that is the case for me. So, you know, even though I believe that I'm not this body, I don't know that in my experience. And I think that's the problem. You know, people think that, you know, you're supposed to then recognize or know that I'm not a body. And if you don't feel that, if you don't have that experience, then you're eventually going to just say, well, that's just a bunch of bull, and not look back, not look at it again. And I always wonder how, I wonder how people could have thought that. But the truth is, you already know that it's true, that you're not this body and this world is not real. But you have the evidence of your experience is completely belies that. So belies belief. Interesting. Okay, I'm going to continue reading, unless you have something to add.
Oh, almost, but go on.
So the person said, you did fine considering the unconscious resistance people have to accepting a non-dualistic message. After all, this is death to the ego. And then here you are with a purely non-dualistic message. Only God is real and nothing else is real. Why would a physically oriented young person want to hear that? Yet you've got the interest of some of them because everyone has the truth buried in their mind, waiting to be uncovered, and they sense it. That's what I just said. Even when you don't expect it, some people listen to you because when they hear the truth, there's a recognition. You remember what the Course said about that, and there's a quote from the Course, "This world you seem to live in is not home to you, and somewhere in your mind you know that this is true. A memory of home keeps haunting you as if there were a place that called you to return, although you do not recognize the voice, nor what it is the voice reminds you of. Yet still you feel an alien here from somewhere all unknown. Nothing so definite that you could say with certainty you are an exile here, just a persistent feeling, sometimes not more than a tiny throb, at other times hardly remembered, actively dismissed, but surely to return to mind again." That's my experience.
And I think if anyone is honest with themselves, somewhere deep in their mind, they would resonate with this. And that's the dichotomy of the two thought systems is we have this enormous resistance. And the reason I knew that I didn't need to say anything because Persa just really said it beautifully in that paragraph, everything I was going to comment on before I started reading, which is that, you know, the resistance really is, you know, that's our work, you know, to overcome that, but not by ourselves, but by looking for the strength of the Christ, the Holy Spirit, the inner kindness teacher in our mind that is always present, that really is the identity that we grow back into, and leave the fraudulent identity behind, ultimately, as we, you know, look at that resistance together and see, you know, my fighting that awareness, whether I walk out of a room with a guest lecturer or I set the book aside, or I, more importantly, set the ideas in the book aside, and, you know, choose to forget what is the real calling that we all have. Eventually, you know, we're going to get tired of something that doesn't work. I mean, and that's why this is really an incredibly practical course, because peace of mind is not a small gift, and eventually we realize that that's really the only thing that's going to make us truly happy and on a consistent basis is realizing that the world we made doesn't make us happy, but fortunately it doesn't exist in truth, and the more we see it as that, and not make it a big deal and not try to breathe life into a dead horse, you know, that the more we realize that the eternal horse, so to speak, is really what we have always been all along, but we just haven't been paying attention to it. Should I read on?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So Gary says, and after that wonderful quote from Workbook Lesson 182, Gary says, oh, yeah, I remember having that feeling even when I was a kid. It was like a part of me knew I didn't belong here. Of course, a lot of people feel that. And the truth is they don't belong here. The good news is that there's a right way to leave the world and go home. Suicide won't do it. If you do that, then you just have to come back here and go through the same old crap all over again. So why not make all the progress you can in this seeming lifetime? Then, if you do come back, you would have already learned so many lessons that your next lifetime will probably be a fun and fascinating one. I think that without the Course, my life would have been kind of sad. I'd been on a spiritual path for a good 15 years when I found the Course, or should I say, you guys found me. But I still felt like there was something missing, because there was something missing. Did I ever thank you guys for stopping by? Persa, that's all right. We didn't have anything better to do. Artin, you must have noticed that as you undo the ego, which is kind of like peeling away the layers of an onion, more and more right-minded ideas come into your mind from the Holy Spirit. Gary, absolutely. Like, I was at LAX a couple of weeks ago going to Madrid, and there was so much to do before leaving, I didn't get any sleep. It was 5 a.m, and I felt really tired. Then I got this thought in my mind, you're not tired. You're having a dream that you're tired. And I got it. What could be tired except for a body? But I'm not a body. So I'm having this dream that I'm in a body and that the body is tired. But it doesn't have anything to do with me. My mind can choose to be spirit instead. And I felt better. In fact, whenever I remember the truth, I feel better. And I can remember the truth in any circumstance at any time. Plus, the Holy Spirit helps me with these ideas. And like that fifth stage in the development of trust concludes in the manual, you know, each step is so heavily reinforced. Every moment we have the opportunity to notice when we are wearied by ego insanity and the drudgery of trying to make a dysfunctional, maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem work. And if we just, you know, like a good dog, drop it, you know, drop the stick that we're trying to fetch, and we think it's going to make us happy. And if we can just say, okay, or the Bob Newhart therapy, stop it, just don't go there. Don't try to make, what's never going to work. Then what's always true, you know, begins to flood back into our mind, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and just tell that dog to sit.
Yeah, sit, stay.
Stay. It seems so simple, and it sure does not seem easy. But, you know, Jesus isn't asking us to do this in this moment, in this instant. Jesus is asking us, you know, just have a little willingness to mm-hmm. give this. You know, just be willing to give this a try. And for me personally, my sense of peace, and I am going to bring this up. We've had a couple of pretty big celebrities who have committed suicide in the last, you know, couple of weeks. That's kind of thrown everybody on their ear about, oh my God, you know, people are killing themselves. And, you know, this is terrible because these people are special, and this is, this is hurtful to me that this could have happened. And in reality, the attraction of death is saying, I'm afraid I'm going to do the same thing. you know, this is really what I want. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but I don't want to talk about that particular aspect of it. I'm talking personally. Since I was a small child, I had a suicidal ideation. I knew I was going to kill myself. I expected to kill myself. I wanted to kill myself. You know, there was just about, you know, every day when something would go wrong, I would just think, I'll just kill myself. That's an idea that, because, you know, a lot of people in my family committed suicide, and, you know, it's just been a part of my life. I'm sure everybody else has kind of the same situation. Or maybe not. Maybe it's just here for me. But I was definitely suicidal for all of my life. And the last probably 5 years, I have not had a thought of committing suicide. I have not said, you know, I just want to kill myself, or it would be better if I was just dead, or, you know, terrible things I would say to myself. But I recognized when this all was happening, and especially when Anthony Bourdain, who I just loved and admired, and he committed suicide, and, you know, I looked at that and I thought, you know, what was it that he believed that made that necessary for him? What was it that he believed about himself and his life and the world that made that a possibility for him? And I think about what was it that I believed about myself and the world and my life and my body that made it possible for me to think about it and not reject the idea of it. And, you know, I realized that it was because I didn't know what I was. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know my relationship to God. I didn't know my relationship to my brothers. I didn't feel like I had a sense of purpose. I didn't know what my purpose was. I thought I had a purpose, but I didn't know what it was. And I was, you know, angry and frustrated about so many things that I really had no control over. And that suicide was a absolute control. Suicide said, I don't care what you do, I'm the one who's in control of this. And even to think about it or fantasize about it or plan it or imagine it was my way of controlling my life and my situation. So no matter whatever happened, I always knew I had an out. I could get out. And You know, who cares about what happened afterwards? You know, the whole idea was, you know, I had an escape route. And so...
An exit tragedy?
Yeah, an exit tragedy. Did you just make that up?
That's I beautiful. Suppose.
An exit tragedy, yes. Exactly. and so... but, you know, I know it's been a good 5 years and probably longer since I've even thought about that exit tragedy, because I recognize, I know what I'm here for. I know who I am. I know what my life is. I know I have no more doubt that everything is perfectly happening exactly as it's unfolding perfectly. Mm-hmm. And you know, the script is written. I have no doubt about that. I see evidence of it in everything I look at. And so, you know, I think, well, you know, if he had known that, you know, then he wouldn't have been in despair, no matter what his situation was. And for me, a long time, I was a compulsive gambler. I wasn't an alcoholic or a drug addict or anything like that, but I was a compulsive gambler. And that made me miserable. It did not make me happy. I did not like losing my money all the time, and I didn't like, but I loved it when I won, and I felt, you know, I mean, it was kind of a manic, depressive kind of thing. You go through these great highs and then these great lows, and all these compulsions really drive you to the edge, always to the very edge of everything. And no wonder, I mean, even when I was a little kid, you know, I was always driving myself to the edge of, you know, how much can I stand? How much can I take? How much can I lose? And so, you know, I stopped that completely. Cold turkey and never, I mean, you know, it'll come up and somebody will say, oh, you know, let's go up to, you know, Cripple Creek or, you know, go to Vegas or whatever. And, you know, I have no need for that. And believe me, before when I was in that situation, I was, it didn't matter what I would go out of my way. I would do anything to get to a place where I could gamble. I mean, this was a compulsion that was just pretty overwhelming for me. And, you know, led me to the brink of suicide over and over and over. And, you know, that compulsion is gone. That desire for anything like that is just not a part of my life at all anymore. And I think, well, you know, did that happen because I asked for it? Because let me tell you what, I would never ask for it. You know, I would say, you know, I'm just sick and tired of this. This is terrible. You know, I should just ask Jesus to help me with this. Oh, but no, I don't want him to help me because he'll take it away from me. And so I had this huge struggle within myself for not wanting to give up this thing that I was so addicted to, and not wanting to ask Jesus to help me because I knew he would, and that was not what I really wanted.
I think you just hit the jackpot there.
Yeah, unintended. Exactly.
No, because if you don't want the help, that's really the clue that you're invested in a dysfunctional identity that doesn't work. And, you know, whether it's addiction to gambling, sex, drugs, rock and roll, food, interior decorating, it could be, you know, any number of things that people just feel obsessive compulsive or in one way or another just can't seem to help themselves. It's usually because that identity is something that we unconsciously believe is going to work for us. And it's, you know, just the dead horse syndrome again is that we have to have the real horse. I'm not sure about that metaphor, but anyway, the reality has to be more important to us at some point. And I think that what you're describing is that you found your real identity, which is the shared interest that, you know, started to have more oomph than the one that's the what's in it for me interest. And, you know, not that you never do things on the level of form, but it's just there's no, big appeal or draw to making the peace of mind that you really are looking for contingent on what happens or doesn't happen in the world. And that's, I think the thing that shifts, doesn't it? Because it's really about identity. Yeah.
It is about identity. And so, you know, I don't know what compelled this person to commit suicide. It could have been an addiction that they had that they just couldn't overcome. It could have been a fear or a, you know, sex or, you know, something that, you know, made them so ashamed of themselves and so guilty and hateful toward themselves that they didn't want to live anymore. You know, because I've felt that. I've been there. And
so all addictions are really ego addictions, you know, if you want to distill it down to.
Yes.
You know, we're addicted to the fear that the ego has sold us and we bought into it as an identity. And we're you know, at some point we get tired of being afraid and being tormented by a thought system that never delivers. Always, you know, over promises and under delivers and never really gives us anything of true value. And at some point we just have to ask ourselves, like, why would I want to invest in a world that was made up to be dysfunctional? And, you know, and just look at the ways, the myriad ways that we, you know, essentially torture ourselves, needlessly. And eventually we just say, okay, I see that motivation, but I'm not going there. You know?
Exactly, and I'm not helpless. That's to me it was like I was helpless, and but I did eventually ask for help. That's the thing. I had to just recognize that, you know, because I kept saying I could stop anytime I want. Isn't that what people say about smoking? Isn't that what people say about drinking? Isn't that what people say about beating their wives? You know, I can stop anytime I want. Well, yeah, you can, but you can't do it alone because you're the one who got yourself in that situation in the first place. And so you really do have to ask for help. And that's with any addiction, the addiction to breathing, the addiction to living in a body. You know, you have to ask for help. And it will be given to you swiftly, and anything you do from then, exactly, you will be, whatever, highly encouraged, supplemented, you know, the powers that be will come to your rescue at all times. And, it really does work.
Yeah. So, a quick aside, since we've been, you know, kind of, touching on addictions, I actually read, well, I'm in the process of reading, I've read the first two sections of a book called Revelatory Events. And I think that's the title, by Ann Taves, and it's basically slightly scholarly, it's a scholarly analysis of three different spiritual, you know, traditions, or what are you going to call it, that have emerged in this country. You know, unique to the USA, and she compares Mormonism, AA, and A Course in Miracles. And I've been reading this in the car when we make trips to Eugene, and my wife and I share the driving. So on half of the trip, which is about an hour and a half, I get to read this book. That's sort of my little treat to myself. And so it's taken me a year to get through the Mormon part and the AA part, which are fascinating. But the AA part was kind of interesting because they were talking about how, you know, I've never aside from having an alcoholic father, I have really not had much dealing with AA other than I know roughly what it's, you know, about. But the idea that to me seems pivotally important is that the willingness to turn things over to a higher awareness or higher power. And I think A Course in Miracles is no different in that, is that, in fact, in Ken's commentary on the manual, Ken Wapnick's an introduction to A Journey Through the Manual, he talks about how the two most important themes that, you know, are woven throughout the manual for teachers are the shared interests as being our new identity, not the separate interest, and then how we need to trust Holy Spirit. We need to trust that inner kindness teacher that we all have, and that's our initial perspective on it, but eventually it becomes what we are as we identify more and more thoroughly with that guidance. And that's really what leads us out of not just the addictive behavior, but the addiction to the ego thought system, when we realize that it just doesn't deliver. It's a very pragmatic course. The ego does not deliver anything we want. Although we think we want it, and we, you know, go to great lengths to try to make it work, but eventually we see that it doesn't make us happy. Anyway.
Exactly. And that's interesting that you've read the Mormon one and the
Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, yeah.
And now you're, because the 12th step of AA, the first words of the 12th step of AA, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. The 12th step is about, we have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps that we've gone through.
Uh-huh.
And people don't think that the 12 steps is about having spiritual awakening, but that's exactly what it is. The big book is just the same, basically. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because they were comparing and contrasting these three different, you know, emergent paradigms and that have gathered a community of people, you know, around the world. And, you know, one of the things particularly about the second portion of this book that caught my interest was the fact that the founders were kind of straddling, you know, in a political sense, the need to try to not endorse nor condemn the religious background of their in the context of where they were you know, raised and so forth, particularly Catholicism, and you know, they were, you know, talking about how, you know, the founders basically had to deal with how to position themselves so that they didn't, you know, either, you know, condemn religion nor endorse it, but kind of walk a middle way of sorts, and then also their interest in mystical experiences as well that was brought out, which was pretty interesting. Yeah.
It is pretty interesting. So I'll be interested in hearing a report on that. And what was the name of the book again?
I believe it's I just usually pick it up. Revelatory Events, I think that's what it was called.
Revelatory Events. I'm going to look that up.
Ann Taves is the author. Yeah, it's a more scholarly treatment of you know, examining those three different traditions and how they came about. Not so much, you know, what they're doing today, I think, but it's more of how do they get going. You know,
it was right,
early genesis of these different.
Okay, so I see that it's listed here on Amazon. So I'm going to check that out because you know, I'm interested in scholarly discussions of these things. No, actually, because I think the more we can look at these things and see how they are the same,
uh-huh.
recognition of the sameness, and I'm interested in what the Mormon teachings are a little bit. I don't really know anything about them. But as you probably have heard, and I've said this a couple times, is that I found my birth father and his family, and they were Mormon, what do you call it, kind of missionaries or settlers. They were sent here to Colorado by, I'm guessing, Brigham Young. I don't know anything about the thing. But so I have a whole family of Mormons that I'm going to be meeting in July.
Oh, well, you might find this interesting then, because the first third of the book really goes into the history quite well. Yeah.
Well, good, because, yeah, I don't know anything about it.
I didn't either. I still don't know much about it.
You know, wives' tales and folklore about Mormonism and, you know, special underwear and getting married in the temple and that kind of crap. But, you know, I don't know, and women don't have souls. I've heard all these kind of things. I don't really know if that's really what the teaching is at all, because it's just like the teachings of Islam. You know,
so that's
we don't
the opposite,
know.
The opposite of high heels, that the women don't have souls, that instead of really high souls,
they have,
have none, huh?
Have no soul. That's
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Or I don't know. Please don't quote me on that, because
okay.
You know, that's only what I've heard.
Yeah.
So
I know is that osmosis is what Donnie calls Marie. That's about the extent of my understanding of Mormonism.
That is pretty funny.
So anyway. Should we read a little on the remaining?
Yeah.
Seven
Why
minutes?
Don't you go ahead and?
Okay. Okay, so I'll continue where Purse is picking up. I said, very good. And, of course, the same is true if you feel pain. Let's say someone feels some pain in their knee. Now they're not actually feeling pain. They're having a dream that they're feeling pain, just like you were dreaming you were tired. But in their dream, maybe they think they're getting arthritis or something. It feels at first like the pain is in their knee, but it's not. We've already taught you that pain is not a physical process. It's a mental process. So the pain is actually in their mind. And more deeply, it's a function of guilt, because in their unconscious mind, they think they're guilty over the separation. Of course, they're not really guilty, because the separation never occurred. It's just a dream of separation that never really happened. And if they can think right-minded thoughts with the Holy Spirit and remember that, the pain might go away. Arden, because of the way the mind works, which we'll get to, they need to apply the idea of the universe being a dream to anything that is having any kind of negative effect on them they may become aware of. Every person, situation, and event, including what's going on with themselves. You may recall a very important couple of questions that Jay asks you in the course. These are some of my favorites too. What if you recognize this world as a hallucination? What if you really understood you made it up? What if you realized that those who seem to walk about in it, to sin and die, attack and murder and destroy themselves, are wholly unreal? Sounds like a Westworld to me. Gary, wow, that reminds me of The Secret of Salvation. let me find that. I figure if Jay wants to tell me what the secret of salvation is, maybe I should listen. Okay, here it is. The secret of salvation is but this, that you are doing this unto yourself. No matter what the form of the attack, this still is true. Whoever takes the role of enemy and of attacker, still is this the truth. Whatever seems to be the cause of any pain and suffering you feel, this is still true. For you would not react at all to figures in a dream you knew that you were dreaming. Let them be as hateful and as vicious as they may, they could have no effect on you unless you fail to recognize it is your dream. Or could he be any clearer than that? Now, why don't you ask any questions you have and also questions you hear in workshops? That way we can cover a wide range of topics. Any commentary on that before we go on?
Wow, yeah.
I figure there might be, yeah.
We can riff all day on this.
Oh, of course.
The whole idea, this last few sentences here, and it kind of goes back to the lesson for today. If you could just recognize that what you're seeing is not the truth, and what you're seeing is a dream, that the characters that you appear to be seeing appear to be, you know, doing crazy stuff or bad stuff or good stuff or loving stuff or, you know, whatever stuff you think is happening, if you could just recognize that this is all a dream and that the individuals who appear to be doing things don't even exist as an individual being. They're a character in the story. You know, and we say this every week, and I say this every day, and yet I'll still bitch at you if you, you know, forget to put the toilet seat down. You know, not thinking, oh, you know, that's just the character. You know, and it has nothing to do with him. Why should I be angry with? There isn't even a him. There is no he. There is no all the definitions that we have for our lives and each other and the things that we see and the situations that we're in, all of it is untrue. Not a single thing of it is true. At not one instant does the body exist. You know, Jesus tells us that in the Course. Not even for an instant mm-hmm. is the body real.
Yep.
Not even for an instant is there a Bruce. Not even for an instant is there a Lynn.
All there is
Christ, yes, the crucifixion. He had to come up with something like that for my name, too. That's not fair. I need to be special.
I'm sure we'll come up with something. Yeah.
I'm sure.
or you'll just decide that your fictional character doesn't need a name and not make a big deal out of it and
that's right.
Be perfectly happy with that.
I guess I've been that way the whole time, so what would change that now? Yeah. So, and yet, what can change that? A thought. What can change my peace and take away my peace? A thought. A thinking. An imagining that something is a certain way or should be a certain way. It's all a thought. And who controls that? Does Bruce control that for Lynn? No. Does Jesus control that for Lynn? No. The only person who controls that is Lynn. And Lynn can say, I could see peace instead of this. Or Lynn could say, hey, this really pisses me off. And
can I say something?
Yes.
Actually, as you were saying that, I was thinking, that's usually, I think, and this is going to be perhaps a semantic thing, but I think it's an important concept that I really appreciate Ken Wapnick's commentary, and I've listened to him comment on this enough times, I think it's sort of, that kind of got snagged as you were saying that. It's like, the decision-making faculty is not the Lynn and the Bruce, it's really the place in our mind that we took with us into the dream, that, you know, we never left, that really is our way back out of the dream. And so it really isn't the Bruce and the Lynn that are making the decision. It's really that place in our mind that's beyond our personas and our bodies that recognizes that we can see peace instead of the ego's insane dream and accept it as our identity. We can see a peaceful identity that then merely observes the hateful, vicious, dream figures that populate our dreams. And sometimes they appear to be nice and, you know, behave in ways that, you know, are culturally more acceptable. But underneath it all, you know, it's ego's savagery, whether it's a Westworld or a political pundit on TV, you know, decrying X, Y, or Z, or, you know, a neighbor complaining about this or that, or a family member, you know, getting after us for whatever, or, you know, a driver on the road cutting us off, or, you know, all those rubber meets the road things are just opportunities to look at how we've made big deals out of fantasies and, you know, taken a hologram seriously and decided that, you know, one arrangement of the holodeck chairs is better than another on a Titanic dream. And it's all pretty silly, isn't it? Yeah. And I just realized we're about out of time, huh?
Yeah, we are out of time. And it is really silly because it is all a thought. It's all a thought.
Yeah.
Everything is a thought.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I could just remind myself of that and bring myself back to that and remind myself that, you know, no one else is responsible for my thinking. And, I'm the one who can make the change just by asking for it, opening my mind to it and recognizing that what is real can't be threatened and what is unreal does not exist.
I think there's some piece of God in there.
There's a little piece of God, and I can see it instead of this.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks
thank
all.
I love you. I'll talk to you next week.
Have a great week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.